Hello and welcome to a football podcast. My name is Devang Desai and I'm joined this week by David Goss and Nick Andrade. Today's show, we chat the Supporters Shield saga. The Merseyside Derby lives up to the hype. Tottenham's epic collapse. The Champions League returns. And as always, it's your questions on Ask AFP. Gentlemen, mid-October, David, how is Wyoming?
I think this is my spot. I'm currently in Colorado. I came back. But I think I'm a Wyoming guy now. Like, whoa, gorgeous state. It's like no people. So you kind of get to do whatever you want. You don't have to wear a mask that often because no one's around you, which is not what it's like in New York City. And there's like mountains everywhere. So you just turn around and you're like, oh, whoa, cool. There's a mountain over there. That's like a cool thing to just be there. And then on the other side, there's another mountain. I met a bear, like legitimately pretty close, like unsafely, technically illegally.
When you say close. Met, did you add him on IG or like, what do you mean you met a bear? Like, how does
yeah,
that?
Well, so it's actually easier. We actually Venmo'd together, but it's easier to just scan their QR code. So I had to get that distance. But legit, a bear came running up the side of the street at my my little posse. We were on the other side. And when everyone froze, turns out maybe I didn't handle it as well as other people did. And then the bear went down the road the other way. I like ran into bison, moose, chipmunks everywhere. It's kind of my vibes. It's, you know,
it sounds like you're in a Disney movie and like birds are like going around your head and you're singing.
When I sing, yeah, that's normally when the birds come out. The magpies, they've got magpies there. Didn't even know that was a real bird.
Wow.
Nick, did you find your inner self in the outdoors this weekend?
No, I was inside. I probably spent 3 hours on my couch thinking about Virgil van Dijk. Legit. Like, my mood was just, I was so sad. I couldn't even sleep because I was going to take a nap after on Saturday. And I just couldn't. It's just so sad. So I stayed inside and I didn't see the weather at all. I don't even know what it was.
Devang, let me ask you this question. To Nick's point, do you prefer if your team plays, would you rather your team play the first game of a weekend, the 7:30 a.m. Eastern time on Saturday, or like the Monday afternoon where you then have to keep thinking about it and wait for it? Which one would you prefer?
Great question. It depends on who my team is facing. I think if it's like maybe a lesser matchup or a non-rivalry game, I love the 7:30 slot. Get it out of the way, start out with your weekend. If you need to get up, get up. But if it's a big match, I kind of like the later start. The problem, like Nick said, like 7:30, the way if it goes a certain way, like it did go, it pretty much ruins your day. Yep. Like, what do you do after that? You do like a candle visual for Virgil. You write some poems, some.
I took a lock of his hair and I made a shrine, actually.
Yeah.
But I agree with that. Like the 7:30, like I was up till 2 the night before. So,
ooh, whoa.
Yeah,
party big Nick.
Wow. No, I there is no parties right now.
Save this for the locker room, dog.
I had like some things to do, okay? I had some things to do. But like I was going to take a nap right after.
Nick was editing podcasts at 2 a.m. on a Friday night.
Yeah.
We wanted to start off the top with this Supporter Shield saga, which if you're listening to this on Tuesday, I'm sure you're well aware of the ongoing dramedy, as I call it, because it is a drama mixed with comedy in terms of the hilariousness of what's going down. But if you did miss it, the Supporter Shield Foundation, which is responsible for handing out the award, put out a statement on their Twitter that because of the pandemic, they were not going to award the Supporter Shield for the 2020 season. Yada, yada, yada. The statement goes on. Things have been different, etc. There's no supporters in the actual stands. It kind of makes it not a typical season for the Supporters Shield. But as you've seen through quite the pushback on this from supporters of various clubs, people have been supporting just the same, just from afar, just from home. The season, though it's been tough, has probably been the toughest of any ever. And it's a testament to the team that can put it together the most, that sacrificed so much with their family and children and friends to do this together to get that prize at the end, which is somehow, I guess, designated by this foundation and not the league, David. So as we record this on Monday afternoon, it appears that the foundation is going to reassess after reading all of the pushback, quote unquote, they got on Twitter and other channels this weekend. Hopefully sanity prevails, David, but I was angry about this. Forget my TFC fandom aside. This is a big trophy for this league. It's a massive trophy. And I get that it's lovely the way it originated and the fact that I think the league liked that this was something that a separate entity created and made its own and made part of this league. I think that is really cool. But I think we've seen it get away from them. And hopefully within these meetings that they have coming out of this, we get some resolution.
So I think the way it was handled was poor. First of all, to announce it this late in the season, and I know obviously 2020 is crazy and things keep changing, I thought that was one of the hardest parts. And then to see a ton of supporters groups come out and say, we didn't feel that we were even notified, let alone asked what we thought about this, seemed to add to a level of confusion. But I don't actually disagree with the idea. I don't think this is a normal season, and I don't know that a champion from this season should go down with the same idea as other seasons. And to your point, that doesn't mean that the team that wins the Supporters Shield or whatever we're going to call it or gets first place this year hasn't accomplished something incredible, because this year has been arguably harder than other years, but it's also been different. And so I think that difference should actually stand out, and I don't have a problem with that. And I think if the fans want to say and supporters want to say, we are a part of the experience in MLS, that's why we started this competition or this trophy, and we're not there, so we don't feel it's the same and it should be given the same way, I'm actually okay with that as well. But it doesn't seem like all the supporters had an opportunity to say that, which is a large part of this problem. And I would have liked to have seen some foresight both from the league and from this group, because this started back in March. So we've had all this time to say, well, for the league to approach and say, do you think you're going to give the Supporters Shield this year? Because it should have been something everyone thought about, because we've kind of discussed it. Devang, we've had questions on every show about whether or not we think the Supporters Shield should count, should it be given the same way, all that stuff. So everyone's thought about this. Why on October 19th or 18th has everyone finally come to a decision? That to me is the most frustrating part of this whole thing.
100%. And I do understand that part of the argument. Obviously, this is in a different season. If they decided this in April or May, totally different situation. I think you don't have teams and players and et cetera putting it all on the line for this something, this carrot at the end of the stick that no longer exists because this decision was made with 5 or 4 games left in the regular season for some clubs. So I think timing, like you said, David, is a big problem with this. And I think my one thing out of this, I think I've seen so many good arguments obviously against this, and I've seen some of the arguments that some people on this foundation and other affiliated members have made to kind of support their reasoning and why they decided to do what they did. But obviously they're in the minority on this, I'd like to believe, at least from what I've seen. And if this has led them to reassess their options like they seem to be doing as you record this, then that's a good thing. And I'm not against anyone changing their opinion or going back on something they decided earlier because they've got more information on the matter. So hopefully in that regard, something is decided. Maybe you don't call it the Supporters Shield, but I think there's other things involved, like those CCL spots and the things that come with the Supporters Shield that have to be figured out, right? So,
But MLS said the money that the players receive for being the top team will be the same. Whatever CCL spot they're awarded, which now there's rumor that maybe Toronto may actually be available for it, which is another curveball of 2020.
What the league told KJ over at TSN was that they wouldn't be, right?
But then I think there's another report that came out on CBC saying that they may actually be available for it. Whatever it is, all those things are going to be the same. Devang, we're going to know who was the top team in the 2020 regular season the same as we know who was in 2019 and 18.
I need that shield. Give me that shield.
I do worry. Yeah. What are you going to eat off of for the next year, right? Like, if Toronto wins it, if Columbus wins it, they're just going to be eating off paper.
So the extreme superstitious person in me is like, we're making all this noise. It's a lot of TFC people making noise about this, rightfully so. But we're going to get this trophy back and not win it. I think that is in the cards, but
oh God,
we need the shield.
So you think TFC supporters are going to fight for it, and then Columbus is going to walk away with it?
I've been well trained to believe the worst is going to happen based on my growing up in the Toronto sports scene, so I can foreshadow this. But first and foremost, figure out what they're doing with this. I think they're going to figure it out. I think, and I just call myself a cynic, but I am an optimist in this regard.
It's and to your point, one of the great things about MLS is that makes it unique in the North American landscape is the ability for supporters to affect The way teams run themselves, they literally give away one of the two biggest trophies. They are influential, I think, in matches. And the selling point to MLS, the fans are cooked into the product more than any other sports league in the US. And I would argue more than any other sports league in the world outside of maybe England and Germany, because MLS doesn't have the soccer product to match other leagues. But what they've done a really good job of, and I don't give full credit to this to the league because I think a lot of it's been natural, hence the supporter shield, is what the supporters have done themselves. And so I would argue a lot of the selling points of why people go to MLS games or watch them on TV is the atmosphere, is the environment. And the supporter shield was an example of that. The league was created. They didn't care about the regular season. The supporters said, no, this is the soccer we want. This is how we want soccer and the culture to be. They created this trophy. They've continued to push it even when it's been considered down. And over the last 5 to 8 years, I think it's really grown in how teams value it. And I think you look at Seattle and they have sort of said, we want to try and win this thing. And they've already won MLS Cup, where I think in the 2000s, Houston didn't care that they didn't win supporter shields because they won MLS Cup. And that was all that mattered. So I think all of this is a great part of the sport. But as things grow, sometimes you outgrow parts of it. And it seems like having five people make this decision is maybe something that you've outgrown and you can restructure the way this is done.
Right. And I think like optically, like by making this decision, you're going to anger the people who are most dedicated to the league the most and raise the most passion about this. And then on the outside perspective, people who are maybe marginally following this league are learning now that possibly the trophy for finishing first doesn't exist anymore. So you're fueling the lazy takes about MLS or the armchair takes about what's wrong with this league and what's wrong with the product, which I frankly disagree with. I think it's a good product, but I think you're giving fire to the people who frankly don't need much to lay into what North American soccer is trying to do in terms of MLS. So I see what you're saying, David. And I again, this is hindsight, but if they announced this in March or April, I'm totally different reaction. I'm pretty confident in saying that. But to do this now, I think the way Greg Vanney reacted to this and the quote he gave, I think you could hear it there. I think I had the quote here, but it's, quote, my players are pissed. It's a huge sign of disrespect to the players. It has arguably been the most difficult season in the history of our league where people have had to put their health at risk to play and put games on television for fans. He went on, but I think Greg summed it up well. And that pushback, though maybe it wasn't expected, that's been heard. So we'll see what the supporters group does.
I think that's unique to MLS. I don't think MLS is a league where fans dunk on players like you see in the NFL and NBA, where it's the culture. And I think there will be a reaction, and I think that's why it's been reopened, because there is a strong relationship between the coaching staffs, the players, and the supporters in MLS. And I think now this supporters group feels that they've let down the players that, to your point, have put so much. I mean, Greg Vanney's saying this because his team lives in another country right now and is just grinding through games in Hartford, Connecticut, which I couldn't even live in, let alone play soccer in, for this amount of time. And they're coming out on top through all of this adversity. And then they find out that they don't get the thing at the end 3 weeks before it happens. And I think that's going to be the biggest part, the reaction from that. And then it's going to open up the conversation again. And I think you're going to see the rest of the fans come in and kind of readjust this.
Hartford, aka Cabo of the Northeast, from what I've been told on TripAdvisor. That's a supporter shield. Hopefully we get a good resolution there. There was soccer played across many parts of the world, of course, this weekend. After the break, we get to your headlines featuring Red Hot TFC. Welcome back to a football podcast. It's time for the headlines. Nick, fire away.
Yeah, we got a lot of MLS talk out of the way, but we got more, especially about TFC. They, of course, won against Atlanta 1-0 on a late winner from Pablo Piatti. Who was the unsung hero of the game for TFC?
So I think you look at this Toronto team. I watched this game, and like the confidence that Richie Lirea oozes with when he plays, like he's so matter-of-fact now about like, well, I know I'm going to beat the guy in front of me. Then what am I going to do? And so you look at the injuries, obviously Osorio going off, Michael Bradley coming on as big, and Piatti scoring the goal. I think he's been a piece that Toronto, outside of Victor Vasquez, has never really had, which is that other piece that can create opportunities off of the big DP or two. All of that's huge, but Larea is that guy to me. But Devang, what stands out in this performance, especially with how hard it was to get this result, is the depth of this team. And I think it may be better than it was in 2016. I think this might be the deepest group Toronto FC's ever had.
Wow. It's a great question. I think Richie's at the point now where it's like pass it to Will stage of how hot he is and how good things seem to happen when he gets the ball. And even if it means coming off the bench to inject some life. But it's funny, David, because I think this team is so confident that they can be still in a 0-0 situation that late into a match and still be confident that they're going to come away with a result. I mean, they didn't need to, of course, but they needed to for their grander aspirations for the season, and they got what they needed. I mean, I thought they were the better team throughout. It's pretty clear Atlanta is not the team they once were, but I thought you could see there was a visible gulf in class throughout the game, but they needed that end product. And Pablo Piatti, a good footballer, sure. I think that we've seen it through and through. But I think what he's brought to the club, just overall, you see how much he's into everything and the way he's celebrating goals with everyone he can and like seemingly being super down for the cause. And it's funny you mentioned Vasquez, because if you want to compare them to that team that won everything a few years ago, they maybe don't have as much game-breaking talent on this side. But I think they are stronger in other areas. Defensively, though, I would probably take that 2017 team.
I think that's fair, but Mavinga didn't play in this game. Bradley's been out for how long? Osorio then goes out. Bradley comes back in with Larea. You have depth on fullback that you've not had because Moro's not even playing. Aro was out for, 2 months coming into this stretch? So they've shown their ability, and I think you have to tip your cap to Ollie Curtis for getting this done, but I actually think you have to look from the top down to just say, you bring Bill Manning in after Bezbachenko's already there, Laiweke leaves, and I just think the organization has done a good job of not making things drastic changes. And that's one of the big things we see in MLS, right? We talk about Ben Olsen. Now DC is not going to know who they are for another 2 years. And it just takes these teams so long to find a culture. And we're going to talk about Orlando in a little bit. And I think culture is a huge part of what you need in MLS. On top of culture, you need structure. You need organizational stability. And Toronto has shown that ability over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I guess since 2013, to have that. And that's what allows you to lose your GM, lose your assistant GM, and still bring in players behind players that you already have that can be difference makers. And they trusted Ollie Curtis to get Pozuelo right out the gates, which was a massive investment for an MLS team. And then they took a risk on Piatti, which was, I think, pushed by Ollie Curtis and the coaching staff saying, we think this team can win now. This is a guy who hasn't played consistently in years. And it's all come together and worked out for this team. And I think there's credit from the ownership down to believe in the structure of the club.
After LAFC beat Seattle, they have since lost to Vancouver and drew 1-1 against Portland. Was their welcome back party a little premature?
I didn't think so after the first 10 or so minutes. I think BWP probably should have scored. Steve Clark made a nice save, but LAFC looked very positive in the beginning, and then it kind of felt like Portland changed the level and took over in the rest of that first half. And I thought Portland was kind of unlucky to lose the way they did. LAFC, not that impressive to me. David, I actually was kind of watching this match more about Portland in the sense of who are the true contenders at the top in the West. And I think if Jeremy Abobasi can be this player, this third game breaker on Portland, it completely changes the game. So even though they gave up that goal late, I think in the positive sense there, perhaps he is ready for that next status jump.
So I agree with you. And him going off hurt at the end could be huge, because if he misses a stretch now with Blanco out, to your point, he can be that guy that can take them over the top. But I think in watching this game, LAFC wasn't that impressive in creating chances. But that's mm-hmm. the one thing that they have coming back in Rodriguez and Rossi. Bringing Murillo in, the new center back, I didn't think they gave up a ton of big chances, especially not as a packed in defense when they were sitting in a block, which I think is something LAFC struggled with a ton over the course of this year. There were moments in transition, which that's where Portland's at their best, and they're one of the 4 or 5 best teams in the league. So that's understandable at times, but I think you saw some solidity with Munir playing at right back and Murillo coming in alongside Segura at center back to say, if Rodriguez and Rossi come back into this side when they get back from international, not even talking about Carlos Vela, because we have zero idea what you're going to get from him, if he'll ever play a game again in 2020. But if those guys come back, I thought, Devang, you saw a bit of the ideas. You saw some control in central midfield and you saw more structure defensively than what we've seen. And that stuff that LAFC can build off of. We thought, to Nick's point, that it was a week or two ago that they would start doing that. But I think this was still a good sign for them in the end.
Orlando clinched their first ever playoff berth. How far do you think they can go in the playoffs?
This is a team that can beat anyone in MLS, and the Eastern Conference is much better than the Western Conference, and Orlando's still shown that they can contend with anyone. We saw it in the tournament, and then they've continued it since then. They can play different ways. They've got multiple match winners. They've got young players who have been good, but they have a ton of veterans. Antonio Carlos at center back and Pedro Gallese at goalkeeper have been some of the best additions in the league to go with Junior Urso in central midfield. Orlando, and that what I was saying coming out of the Toronto point was, Oscar Pereja has built a culture and there's an expectation from them that they're going to win, that they're better than other teams, that they can get through tough moments. And that's what you need to get to the top. And then you've got a guy like Nani, who at any moment in a game can be the best player on the field. Not every team in MLS has that. So Orlando has all the ingredients. And I think it's been impressive how quickly it's come together. But Devang, I see in the way that they clinched, like, this wasn't a team that backed in as the eighth place team in a year with the playoffs expanded. This was a team that clinched early because they've been so consistent.
I did enjoy perhaps removing the last lingering stink of the prior admin and the bad year since they came in the league, that they did concede in the fifth minute of injury time and then did draw, but they got in thanks to that TFC win. They did clinch, but I think you hit the nail on that. This league is about builders. And if a guy can do it in more than one spot, then you definitely know, I think you're on the right track in terms of a hire, and Oscar Pereja getting him in to the picture. I believe this club is being sold right now, David as well. So I think it's very important, I think, for the new group to make sure that they have Oscar's trust going forward. Because you see, I think we've seen it across the league as well. It's not exactly a blueprint, but there's a way to do things wrong. And I think to avoid those steps is massive. It's not necessarily about getting things right all the time. And Oscar Pereja is not only getting things right, but he's avoiding, I think, the missteps that Orlando took in the past. In the East, like you said, if I'm Toronto, that's definitely an Orlando side I hope someone else gets to play before the Eastern Conference Finals, perhaps.
MLS announced steps to combat racism and increase black representation. How positive of a step is this?
It's a positive step, and I think this is what we chatted about earlier, David, a few weeks ago about what MLS needs to do next, and talk is good, but let's see some things put in place, and I think this statement does that in terms of announcing some of the initiatives they're going to take part in, including surrounding the election coming up in a few weeks. With that said, though, I think what happened in the NHL with the Hockey Diversity Alliance, you saw, led by players like Evander Kane and Hakeem Olajuwon, they ended up parting ways with the NHL over lack of action, basically saying that talk was cheap. And though the words were nice, nothing was really put in place. And I think if the same thing happens with MLS, you could possibly see that as well from the Black Players Union and what they've built so far. So I love what they're doing in terms of what I've seen on paper, but let's see the next steps.
Yeah, I agree with Devang. I think we talked about it when we brought up Dallas and Reggie Cannon last week, I believe, that talk was cheap and it was a good start, but it doesn't mean anything. And this is action. It's money to help build out the BPC to allow these players to create a real organization, because right now you've got guys who are playing full time and doing so much work on the side with this. It would be nice to have an organization for them to kind of be able to hand off to at times and not have to be so involved constantly. And so you see that Devang mentioned all the work being done going into this election, which shouldn't be a one-time thing. This should be every election. It shouldn't just be national elections. I know you guys are Canadian, but for us, people just don't vote, and they don't vote in primaries and they don't vote in midterms. And that's all as important, if not more, than what's going on now. And then I think the big piece to me, and I think the BPC has been so good the way they've thought about all of this and gone about it, is they're trying to use these clubs as magnets for the community. So one of the parts of this is finding black-owned businesses to use as suppliers for food, for cups, for whatever around MLS clubs in these cities. And that's how you create change. And to the point, I think it was one of the players on the BBC, I don't remember who was like, it's not about getting black players on the team. Your interns in the ticket sales office should be from different backgrounds. And that's one of the things that MLS players can force their owners to do, is to change the business practices, at least at their teams, if not farther, because all these people own massive business structures. And so it's been impressive to see how these players have gotten the league to follow through. And this is a good roadmap to say, we don't have to fight you every 30 seconds, because now we have these points that you have to touch on and have to work with year after year.
Alfonso Davies and Jonathan David among finalists for the 2020 Golden Boy Award. Considering what Davies has done this year, does he have a good shot at winning it?
He 100% does, Devang. I looked at the list. I looked at it twice. I'm checking it again. I think it's him. It's Sancho, because I don't think Haaland can win it over Sancho with the numbers Sancho put up for the full year in the Bundesliga. And I think Greenwood gets in there, that top five as well, just because of the pure amount of goals he scored. But I don't think anyone on this list was as effective for as successful a team as Davies was over the course of last year.
Wow. Well, Bukayo Saka has another piece of bulletin board material that he can add for the haters. I think you're right. I think Fonzie should win this based on how important he was for a club that was that good in Bayern Munich. I was wondering if, like, maybe a possible name thing, like if it would be a Haaland, because he is like the it guy and he scores goals and he's got that demeanor. So if it becomes like a popularity thing, I wouldn't be surprised. But on merit, and I'm not the Canadian, this is not the Canadian to me talking, I think it should be Fonzie, which again, what are we talking about? But I think that's it.
It's amazing that David got on this list, because when you look at it,
exactly.
I think there was only one other player who didn't play in a top five league. It was a player from Salzburg who did play in Champions League that got on this list. So Alfonso Davies, for the work, because this is based off the work he did in Belgium. It's not really based off what's going on this year now that he's in France.
Right.
To be noticed that way. And I think the transfers help, because it's a big money signing. People have to notice. But to be noticed that way is incredible. And I agree with you on Davies, but I still think Sancho, I think, was second in voting last year. And for him to continue to perform in the Bundesliga over the course of last year, I think it's going to be him. But Davies has to be top three, and I think he should be one or two.
Also, just want to say, the Golden Boy Award.
I know, it's so weird. Yeah,
it just sounds so stupid. Weird.
European people are weird. Stop being weird, European people.
It's like, you're super proud. Here's my 2020 Golden Boy Award. Okay.
And then it's like, they talk about it like it's a... Oh, God. Thank you, Nick.
Forge FC enter CONCACAF Champions League prelims this week. How far do you think they can go?
I'm not going to lie, I was a bit surprised this caught up on me so fast. It also, I was a bit surprised that Forge will travel to El Salvador this week for this match. I thought international soccer in general was a bad idea based on what is happening in the world, and I was a bit stunned to realize this was happening, but so be it. Hopefully everyone remains safe. I don't know a lot about Municipal Limeno, the team they will be playing, although that their club badge features a pig playing soccer, which is actually amazing. You should check that out. I don't know, David. I don't have a good answer for you. I was hoping your CONCACAF knowledge would shed some light on this Salvadorian powerhouse.
So they're not really one of the powerhouses, which is why...
I was reading that as well. I should have redacted that word.
So this is a winnable game. They then would move on to play Taro right now, who is a big team from Panama, but Panama hasn't restarted soccer yet. So I actually think Forge have a decent advantage in there. And then the way it nets out, they basically, you don't have to play Herediano or Saprissa until a semifinal, in which they would potentially be up against Saprissa or one of the big Honduran teams. So this is actually a decent draw for what Forge could end up with. They could end up playing a team from Jamaica in the quarterfinals, and then you get into the semis. And obviously at that point, it's deep in a competition. You're always going to have to play good teams. But I think the way the bracket rolled out is as good as it could have gotten for Forge. And the way they play fits a competition like this, which is they don't need to play expansive. They can sit in a good block, they're strong defensively, and then they can hit you off on the counter through Becker or Crutzen, whoever's playing those balls. So I think this fits perfectly. And for Forge, how cool would it be? Because last year they had to go from CONCACAF League to league play and back and forth. And this time you'll have the whole league watching you. because no one else is playing. And for them to make a run right now, I think could really make some good buzz. And I think there's a legitimate possibility.
Vilified in North London, deified in Hamilton for this Pro Forge talk. David Goss, excellent.
That's it for headlines. When we return, David and Devang break down the insane Premier League weekend for you.
Welcome back to a football podcast. It was a breathtaking weekend in the Premier League. Goals, goals, goals. We're setting records. We're setting records for takes online after incredible incidents. People's accounts should be banned and locked away, but they go on tweeting because that is the way we do things in 2020. 2-2 is the final score. The major takeaways, of course, Virgil van Dijk's knee injury, the result of a rash Jordan Pickford challenge that was not punished because VBD was ruled offside. Michael Oliver did not check his television on the pitch. He relied on the VAR official in the booth. There was another VAR incident. Jordan Henderson's winner ruled not valid because Sadio Mane was a fraction offside, if even that. I promised Nick I'd let him yell for 2 to 3 minutes what has happened here. So take it away.
Actually, Devang, I think we should lift the curtain and say, we actually weren't even going to record a show this week. This doesn't exist. Nick just needed a place to vent, so we're all here for it. Nick, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I just, listen, I get VAR and I get what the rules are right now. But if you can't focus on what happened after the play just because it's offside, and I think David Coote said that he was mostly focused on the offside when he was looking at VR when Virgil went down. But you have to do something about that. Like, how does that go uncalled?
I agree with you, Nick. I think the offside idea, that's talking about a penalty. But a penalty doesn't exist. There's still a red card to be given.
Exactly.
And I don't think Jordan Pickford, by the way, should be suspended for any level of games. I don't think it was that egregious. I know Nick will feel differently, and that's fine. But I thought Jamie Carragher said it pretty well afterwards. It was like, he's like, someone broke my leg. I almost broke Nani's leg. Like, I thought it was a soccer play, at least, but it was a red card.
Yeah.
And who cares if the player's offside or not? The red card still exists, even if you're not going to give a penalty, which is the way it should have been called. And to Nick's point, you've got extra people sitting by a TV watching this game. You could have someone have that thought process, because there's not just a VAR. There's an assistant VAR. And it's like, no one really came to the idea of like, yeah, that's offside, but this guy just tore this guy's ACL. Maybe that's a red card.
I was going to say, too, the reason why I'm upset about Jordan Pickford's incident is because it's happened before. This man is, and I don't want to criticize his game, but he is clueless and reckless so many times that I've seen.
He's bad. He's bad. I think it's fair to say he's bad.
Yeah.
Nick, I think that's, and I think I saw people saying he should be out for as long as VVD is out and suspended for somehow, which I don't think is enforceable, but a retroactive red card probably would have gone a long way to cooling some hurt, some legitimate hurt. It was a terrible challenge. I don't think a fractional offside should remove the fact that it happened and that VVD is gone and that there probably should have been some repercussions for that. The call on the Hendo winner. I mean, if this is the way we want to play now, sure. I think technically it is right, I guess. But are we okay with this? Like, I at a certain point, I mean, there's times when this will go the way my club will benefit from a call like this, and it has happened before, and it's happened in the inverse way. And I hate VAR just as much when it happens then. But I'm not ready to resign myself to this. Like, I think we can observe what is happening and probably reassess the way we're using it. Because we're not that far into it. Like, this isn't like we've been doing this for 15 or 20 years. Like, this is something that's new. There are going to be mistakes. We don't have to live this way, is what I'm saying.
So, I don't know. I think I disagree with you. And I think, one, I feel like we watch MLS week in and week out, and we watch the World Cup, and I don't know that we're upset with it. I think the way it's been done in England has been poor. It's been worse than Germany. It's been worse than here, where you don't even have that many referees who are eligible to even do this because you don't have so much soccer culture. So I think that's part of it. And I don't dislike VAR or goal line technology, because I think there's some things that are lines. And if something's crossed the line or not physically, not like, you know, the words you say because you cross the line, that should be called. Like, we shouldn't be standing here discussing whether or not a ball crossed the line on a Monday after a game. The rest of it, we want it to be up to the referees. and to be subjective. And I think it still is because we're still complaining about the choices the refs made. The offside one is a tough one because they're having trouble finding the physical line and it's taking so long. And I think that's a big reaction to people. And I agree with it. But if they're off, they're off. Like I can remember before VAR where there's crazy offside calls and you go back and watch it after and you're like, oh, wow, it was by an inch of his heel. It's still as ridiculous then whether they use VAR as it is now because it's the same call, no?
I rarely say this, but if you look at something the NFL has done, and I think, Nick, you alluded to this off the air, but if it's something like if it is not conclusive, if it is not easily distinguishable from a viewing once or twice, then maybe you leave it. Maybe it's that idea that if it is fractional, then it's not something we have to get bogged down into. But I appreciate getting things right. Don't get me wrong. I think that is a positive aspect of this, but something like Oliver not checking the monitor on the field is weird to me. It's like the fact that they wouldn't tell him that. And I think that, like you said, the implementation perhaps has been worse than the actual technology itself. Again, which they can fix. But I feel like there's also a groundswell of anger directed at many arrows at the idea of VAR. But perhaps it's not at the right place, like you said, David. So I think it's a shame as well, because I think if you look at the game and Everton getting a result after the way it started and the way Mane starts the game and kind of it's like, ho-hum, okay, it was a flash in the pan. This is Liverpool. Let's not kid ourselves. I thought they responded excellently. And all the things that we've seen so far from Everton kind of showed up again as well after Richarlison got sent off and they were trying to hang on. But I think for me, David, this kind of confirmed that they're legit. Everton is for real. For real for me being top four contenders. I don't know about league. What do you think?
I agree with you because I think when you look at Everton right now, they showed in this game they can contend with everyone, but it was their best 11. So over the course of this season, you're not going to be able to play your best 11 every week. And I don't know that Everton has the depth to contend where take a look at Liverpool. They lost Van Dijk in this game and then they still, I thought, controlled large sections of this game because they still have two of the three best attacking players in the league and they've been missing Alisson and they've still been good. So I don't know that Everton has that depth. Best 11 and the ideas of how they want to play, I think they can contend with every team in the league and it'll come down to health and other things like that. But this was one of those moments where Liverpool scores early and you're like, here we go. It's going to be 3-0 in 25 minutes. They're going to start making mistakes. They're going to get pressed out of the back. And Everton, I thought, reacted well. And what was really good from them was Richarlison pushed high alongside Calvert-Lewin. And that allowed space for James Rodriguez to come underneath. If he can pick his head up, he's one of the best in the world. Liverpool, their idea was to press him, keep his head down, force him to play back. But because of Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin's movement, James Rodriguez had the space he wanted and he started to hit those switch field balls and drive into the middle. And that changed everything for Everton. And I thought it was a really good, as you said, reaction to that from them to show, no, it's not just confidence that we play on. We have the structure of a good team and that's what good teams do.
The banter results roll forward. Chelsea, Timo Werner finally off to Schneid in the Premier League. Two goals in the first half. The first goal, just fantastic. That's the Timo Werner we saw at RB Leipzig. That's the Timo Werner we're going to see probably for years to come, no matter where he plays. Absolutely lights out finish, lights out play to even get behind the defense like he did. Kepa's going to Kepa, though, and things Chelsea-fied pretty quickly. I think Danny Ings, all he does is score. Che Adams, that goal, ridiculous, David. But it's another example, I think, of a team that should see out a result if we're going to give them credit for maybe being for real in a season where it is pretty wide open. Disappointing from Chelsea, and it's the same things again where is it criminal malpractice to put Kepa out there continuously if you're going to see stuff like this? Or is this, okay, we don't want to throw Edward Mendy into the fire where it's going to be the same kind of deal where he's under siege like Kepa seems to be? Because I feel like this point, putting him out there repeatedly is just mismanagement, Frank.
But to your point, and I ask this, if you put Mendy out there, is it a mess in front of him that he won't be able to succeed?
Exactly, and you ruin another keeper as well, which you can't really get. You can't afford to get wrong again this quickly, right?
Financially, I don't think you can afford to. And it's one of those things, you look at this Chelsea team, the way they played in those first 30 or so minutes, but also the group that was out there. It's the first time we've really seen Pulisic and Havertz and Werner in his right spot. And then you get Jorginho alongside Conte, which should be their best midfield. And I think the idea would be Ziyech in there instead of Mason Mount, although I don't know. Frank Lampard might play Mountain in goal if he can, because he's so obsessed with him. So it was kind of like the group and the performance you wanted from Chelsea. And then it was the reminder of, oh, right, we spent all this money in the attack and the problems are at the back. And when problems are at the back, it's so deeper than just, well, there's an issue at center back. It changes the way everyone has to play because you don't have confidence. So you don't want to take risks. You don't want to lose the ball. You don't want to pass back in places where you should. And it changes the way you can play. And I think that's what we're seeing from Chelsea and Devang. I don't know how you get over that. Because if the personnel is wrong or the coaching is wrong there, it's not going to change over the next few months. And you start to get in a dangerous spot where it's young guys who are settling in as a group. And do you affect the culture long term coming out of this?
It'll be interesting. I thought Kai Havertz was singularly to blame for the Danny Ings goal in the first half. Kind of dilly-dallying around it in his own half. Dispossessed, single, small chance. Danny Ings turns into a goal, which he does a lot. And I think we should give him more credit. It's weird. I feel like we overvalue English strikers because they're English, and we undervalue English strikers because they're English. And I think Danny Ings falls into that category. But give him a chance like that, it's game on. It's a massive problem. And again, as a neutral, kind of hoping Chelsea draws points, it was pure nectar from the gods to see Theo Walcott create the equalizing goal, even though I think Vestergaard got a touch on it. But these are matches you should win. These are matches you cannot blow points on. I know it's topsy-turvy at the top, and teams that shouldn't drop points are dropping them, but that means you got to finish off games, which another club competing for the top four also failed to do in stunning fashion. Tottenham, up 3-0. Son and Kane doing the business, looking fantastic. People waxing poetically about the new Jose Mourinho. Tottenham for real. This is going to be a big year for Spurs, only to watch West Ham score 3 goals in the final 10 minutes and change to, boy, send me into a height of delirium after a rough weekend of football watching myself. Two things, David, for me, I was making fun of people talking about Mourinho's Tottenham being fun to watch, but they were. That first half was electric. And I, there are a few people I like watching with the ball at their feet more than Son at this point in time. And when Harry Kane plays like that, you can understand why they could score for fun, even if it is a Mourinho team.
First of all, I'd like to say shout out to Sean Kay. This one was for you.
I wonder how he actually felt. Oh, man. He probably had a worse day than I did.
Potentially, he did. But this goes back to the way Mourinho wants to play. They don't control games. And so, like, even after they put together the 3 goals, they were so plodding the rest of the game. And you're not going to knock a team that scored 3 times. But it didn't feel like they had ideas of, yeah, let's put this one to bed. Or we're going to just possess the ball and dominate the game. They don't do any of those things. And so it left the window open. Now, Lanzini scored an outrageous goal in an outrageous scenario from a guy who hasn't even played yet this year. Like, it didn't really make sense. And I kind of agree with what Mourinho is saying. This happened, but to the point with Tottenham, I don't think they have an idea of how they dominate games. The only thing Mourinho knows is he wants to be bigger, faster, more physical, and more aggressive than the other side. But that doesn't tell you, well, here's the structure of how we're going to get a lead and how we're going to see it out. And I think you're seeing that with every other team in the Premier League now, pretty much every other team. Like, there were a lot of groups a year, 2, 3 years ago in the EPL that didn't have clear tactical identities. And I think you've gotten rid of a lot of that. And so Mourinho is almost an outlier in that way. And I think you see it for Tottenham and it hurts them. They have the individuals. Like, you can't have that conversation anymore. Obviously, the announcer really wanted Gareth Bale to score a goal when he came off
really
the bench.
Badly.
Really badly. Hey, you want to go viral, Devang? Everyone knows. But the number 9, Gareth Bale, and he should have put the chance away. That would have made it 4-2, and he beat the guy by himself, and he'll add to this group. But Devang, I don't look at Tottenham and say, oh wow, this is how they're going to beat it. This is what they're going to do against this team. This is what they're going to do against Sheffield. This is how they're going to play against Leeds, because they're so reactive to the way the other teams are. And I think that makes it hard to see out victories.
This is definitely a fair point. I thought that mistake Havertz made on the Ings goal, I thought Harry Winks did this catastrophically so at this point in the game, where he kind of just lets the ball kind of float. And Lanzini, 1 out of 1,000 hit. Like you said, I don't think there's that. Try that again. That is going into the 90th row of the stands. But as Moo says, football happened. Spurs are not going to be champions just yet. But I do think it's getting cliche to say this, that it might be a year for parity, but they have enough guns up top, like you said, David. And I wonder defensively, this is a league right now where I think Villa and Arsenal might be the best teams defensively on record. So who the hell knows what to expect?
I've had enough of this propaganda. Holy crap. I have a question for you guys, though. Actually, just talking about these results and seeing them and seeing Man City kind of flounder a little bit, seeing what Man United is up to, and now Liverpool lose Van Dijk. I got to say, this is probably the most parity ever in terms of we don't know what's going to happen by the end of the season.
I would put a fiver on Man City to win the league, though. It might not have been convincing, and I might be showing my bias by saying it was a good effort from them to win 1-0 against Arsenal, but I thought they will be the best team by the end. And it's weird that I feel confident saying that, but I think squad-wise, I have confidence that they should win the league, and I would place a small bet on that, perhaps.
I think it's weird for you to say that because I just think they haven't looked like themselves, I think, over the course of the beginning of this season. They haven't looked as comfortable and flowing against teams you think they'd beat up on. And then on the flip side, Pep's kind of treated these bigger games like he does Champions League with the tweaks and the changes and all that stuff. And I'm not against that because he's a genius and it's worked for him. But over the course of a season, it's tough to continue to do that and have guys settle in. So I think there's massive question marks around them. I agree with what Nick said. The funniest part about this whole thing is in the middle of this, those teams on the top are like, we're so much better than everyone that we should just run the league by ourselves. And it's like, well, it kind of is hard to give you guys pure voting control if you're not actually better than anyone else on the field. And it was a funny weekend for that to happen after everything that happened with Project Big Picture, which is such a British name that can go along Golden Boy and all that stuff. But yeah.
And you can clip this, Nick, for when you guys want to make fun of me when Man City finishes fourth somehow. But I have a hunch on this. Also, chefs Aston Villa. I mean, Jack Grealish, I've talked about him a lot. I like him a lot as a player. I like watching him play. But in terms of business, this Ross Barkley addition, not flashy at all. He's kind of been around. I think a few years ago, it's a big news. It's a big deal that he's possibly going to Aston Villa. But I think at this point, it wasn't big news, but he's been the perfect fit. And I think, sure, it's a winning goal against Leicester late, but I think overall he's been a really nice addition to that side. And again, we can stop saying it's early at a certain point, right? If Aston Villa hangs around into November, I think the calculus changes.
So two things. One, agreed, and you have to look at overall points, because what happened with Leicester City winning, which was awesome, was it was a low point total. So I think if we get to halfway or along, and the top of the table is so much lower than what we expect at that point of the season. Obviously, date-wise, that'll be different because of all of COVID-19, but we'll know by games. If you see it a little bit lower, then you can start to say, yeah, this is attainable for some of these teams that don't have as much depth. The other thing I'd say is with Ross Barkley and the same with Danny Ings, we just give up on guys. One, too quickly,
exactly.
And two,
exactly.
I don't think we respect the level of the game players are playing at, and I think we spoke about this with the Bundesliga a few weeks ago with Kramaric, who's now at Hoffenheim and scored to beat Bayern, and then 3 days later was like, well, he has to go to Bayern now. And it's like, why can't we just respect the fact that Danny Ings is just really good at Southampton, which is a top 10 team in the EPL, and that's his role and that's where he fits in. Like, that's all fine. He doesn't have to try to push his way back into Liverpool because he didn't do it one time. And I think the same with Ross Barkley, and I think we've seen it now. I thought Leicester proved it when they did win the title with the way Drinkwater played and all those things, although I guess now he's disproved it again. But like, there are just guys where that's fine, that's their level. And I think Everton's kind of an example of that. And I think, Devang, that's why we've been so excited about them, is like, they're guys in the right spot and they're comfortable and they're enjoying their soccer.
Sound a soft klaxon, because I'm going to sound real soft right now. But I think Grealish extending his deal at Villa and Danny Ings, it looks like he's going to extend his deal at Southampton. That's good to see. And like, to piggyback on your point, I think it is good that there are good players who are not on all of the same teams. And parity, like Nick mentioned, this is exciting. I mean, I didn't think we thought Liverpool would run away with this, and it sucks a lot that VVD is out, but really is hard to bet who's going to come out on top, and it makes for each week to be blockbuster viewing ahead. Okay, that is the Premier League for this week. After the break, it's the mailbag. Ask AFP coming up next.
Ooh.
Welcome back to A Football Podcast. It is now time for everyone's favorite mailbag segment, Ask AFP. Thanks to everyone who sent their questions this week. If you didn't get the chance to send in your own question, just hop on Twitter and use the hashtag AskAFP and send them our way. The first one is from Danny, and he asks, what Champions League matches are you most excited for this week?
Of course, it's Rennes versus Krasnodar at 3 o'clock on Tuesday. Eduardo Camavinga, Arsenal target, lock it in. RUR, who? New target. But, I mean, I will watch it for Camavinga as well. I like watching him play. But I'll go PSG, Man United. Man United, of course, big win over Newcastle 4-1. All is well. Ollie in. Harry Maguire scored. He's good now. All forgiven. But I'm very curious about the Champions League and this club because I'm not super convinced by pretty much anything. And I think PSG trying to build off what was really a successful campaign. I know they didn't win in the end, but it was a tremendous run, a very strong defensive run for PSG, which I think is maybe something we wouldn't be expecting. I'm curious to see how they do against a pretty strong United attack, all things considered. So that's probably the one I'll circle.
Yeah, I think that's the obvious one. PSG's had a weird start to the season because half their team has coronavirus, but seems like they're starting to get back together. If I had to pick out another game, I'm going with Chelsea-Sevilla with a way and to another team that ended last year strong to win Europa League. They'd started strong. They have a good idea of the soccer they want to play. And then you've got a team in Chelsea, which are they contenders in a competition like this? Where do they stand? And we just spent a segment talking about that. So I think that's a pretty obvious one. And the other one that stands out is Bayern Munich, Atletico Madrid, because, you know, me and Simeone. So it's a good one.
Clay asks, who is going to be the next Ben Olsen in MLS, the player turned coach that a club hangs on to way too long?
So this is an awesome question. It's hard to say where guys are going to get opportunities. I think one of the guys who seems to be in a similar mold, who I don't know if he'll get the head coaching job where he is now, is Matt Beisler. Because I think everyone sees him as like that guy's going to be a coach one day. He's a center back, but he's a little undersized. So he's so intelligent with the way he plays. Although I don't know that PV is going to leave that job. So he's probably going to end up at a different club, but I would not be surprised if he ends up as a coach. So I'd say him and maybe Dax McCarty. Those are two guys who are like going to be cult hero type guys who are fiery and have the history in the league. And you don't actually know how good any of them will be.
You stole my Dax McCarty answer. I'm livid. Gah, I should have gone first. I had Dax. Maybe Ali Bedoya is my shout. I could see maybe not at Philly, though, based on Jim Curtin seeming to be there for a while unless he gets poached. But I could see Bedoya maybe getting into that kind of sphere. Hanging on too long, though, like shouts to Ben Olsen. I know I like to rip on him and make fun of him for doing funny stuff and yelling a lot, but something to be said for someone who was a builder, like I mentioned earlier in the show, and someone who's been vital for DC, and it is back to square one. Like, they're basically learning how to ride a bike all over again without Ben Olsen being there. So it's nice to see some change and some fresh blood, but it's not, I think this question, the way it's phrased, I understand it, but I don't think Ben Olsen was all bad, but it probably was time to go.
Throw in a couple another names in there who seem like players who are going to go on to coach where they are. Stefan Fry in Seattle, Diego Valeri in Portland. I think those are two like simple ones. I'm sure in the end, Nagby will coach Columbus whenever Porter's done there. So yeah.
Sean asks, is Zlatan going to score 30 if he stays healthy? And I got to say, maybe COVID actually maybe healed him and made him stronger. I don't know. That's usually how it goes with him.
It seems to have made him more powerful. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't watch retirement leagues, Devang, so this one would fall to you.
I watched a lot of Serie A this weekend and I loved it. It was fantastic. I think the Napoli-Atalanta game was fantastic. That Politano goal, amazing. Irving Lozano, another worldie as well. But AC Milan looked fantastic. Zlatan, I mean, it's ridiculous to see what he's doing. But this Pioli staying thing and the fact that it was close to being a completely different setup, it's interesting the different path AC Milan could have taken. Because currently, as it stands, I think if you look at this side with Alexis Salamakers and Van Aster and Kessie and Leao, like there's a lot of good players here. There's enough good players here to contend for the league as they're doing currently. And we mentioned parity in the EPL. I mean, Juve, it's early, but it's not going to be smooth sailing for Pirlo, it seems. So it's pretty cool to see, as someone who grew up at a time when AC Milan was one of those it clubs. It's nice to see them back. It's not bizarre to see Zlatan doing what he's doing, like, but 30 might be a bit much, but just overall, I would recommend watching AC Milan, which is not something I would have said a few years ago for sure.
So I think to the conversation about the EPL, Real and Barca lose this weekend. Bayern has struggled. You've got Sassuolo at second place in Serie A. Like, I don't know that this is an England thing. I think this might be, this was the effect of not really having an off season and teams not being as cohesive and things changing. I think this has all been the effect of that, is it's actually led to more parity, which I don't think was expected. So I think the push to get five substitutes out, and we saw it in the EPL, was, oh, well, the big teams will dominate because they're deeper and no one else can contend with them. That's not what we've seen so far. And I would say on Milan, we had this conversation in the quote-unquote offseason about bringing Zlatan back. And I said, I want them to move on. I want them to get younger and continue. I was wrong, not because Zlatan is so good, but because they already had a lot of these young players. And as you name them, Kessie and Teo Hernandez and Leal. And those guys have just developed over the last year. And now they're ready to lead a team. And they weren't those guys a year back. And in my head, they had to go out and get new players. And that was wrong. They had the guys in the club. They just need to give them the chance.
Also, Kolarov might be washed. I think he's 80% washed at this point, based on my analysis after this game.
Travis asks, if you were in charge of replacing the physical supporter shield, what object would you replace it with? So I guess, what is your ideal trophy?
So I love the World Cup. I think it's a very cool shape. But if I'm replacing something, I love, my favorite utensil is the spoon. And if I could use it more often, I would. So some sort of golden spoon, maybe a large golden spoon, because then you can get back into that Stanley Cup situation where it's like, you can put stuff in a bowl and then you can eat with the trophy rather than eat from the trophy. And that puts you in a unique setting. And I think, Devang, for this league to be a premier league by 2022 and one of the top 10 leagues, you need to set your trophies apart. And there's a way to do it.
A spoon is 2010, man. You have to get with the times. I'm assuming by 2030, we've eschewed spoons entirely from our society. So I don't know if this is a move to
me. Maybe
I believe there will be a utensil developed in this time that will completely just make the spoon obsolete. So is it wise to make that call?
Do we just go chopsticks?
My idea was that whoever wins the trophy, their supporters choose what it is that they lift. So if it's Toronto, then the groups together get together and decide what is the trophy. Or if it's Portland, the Timbers Army decides. Or if it's DC, etc. Obviously, this is contingent on some planning beforehand, and some teams or supporters groups will have trophies they never give out because their team didn't win. But I think that would add a nice personal element that maybe this group of five was trying to key in on when they canceled the whole damn thing.
I was so stupid, though. You give a wooden spoon to the worst team. So a golden spoon is the opposite of a wooden spoon. Devang, I was right.
Guys, this is so easy. It's obviously a sword, okay? Wow. You know, when they're celebrating and they lift the trophy and they...
You went back to 1620, not 2020, man.
You lift
ridiculous.
A sword a in the air with your teammates? Yeah. Oh my, the pictures would be amazing.
Yeah. And the... It would give every other team a chance in the playoffs because the injuries coming off the sword for the team that had just won it would be pretty substantial.
The only place you could safely have the parade would be at medieval times based on how you could brandish the sword. So I don't think this is...
Everyone's getting a glass of mead and a turkey leg. Beautiful. It's a good addition.
Their food there is horrible. I hate it. That's my hot take. Ugh.
Do they put the health intake, like, you know, on food packages, they have like sodium, right, fat. Do they put that on there for medieval?
Not going to lie, I've never been to an actual one. Okay. So I only know through TV and movies.
The tomato soup is disgusting. Just going to put that
I've heard a pre-roll for medieval types on our ad roll for this show. So it'll be interesting if it comes up.
We love medieval times. The food is amazing. Yeah, yeah.
After I've shaved myself with Manscaped, I only eat at medieval times.
Quick free drink with Muddy York before the match or before the sword match. I don't know what you call it, but sword match. Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it.
Finally, I have an answer to this, guys. So I'll deal with it. Okay. Dave asks, why do British people pronounce it Davis rather than Davies when it comes to Alfonso Davies or like Ben Davies or something like that? And I'll tell you why. It sounds like they're saying Davis, but they're actually saying Davies really fast. So it's like Davies, Davies. So it sounds like Davis, but it actually is Davis. It's like British people, they say mum instead of ma'am. That was the longest time. I always thought in British TV shows they were calling, you know, just random women their moms, but it's actually ma'am, and they just say it fast, mum. There you go.
Is this a joke answer, or is that a serious answer?
No, that was serious. That was serious to me. Okay.
So my answer was just going to be because British people do dumb things, but I guess we could take Nick's.
It's true, guys. Come on.
They called him Jazzy Altidore for 3 years or whatever it was. I'll never forget.
It wasn't Josie that was bad. It was Hull and everything else that's under. Yeah, okay,
let's exactly. Get that on the record.
Yeah. But Devang, do you know actually? I don't know. That's my answer.
I don't know. I honestly, what you said sounds plausible. It vexed me though. I mean, the final Champions League final last year, the Davies thing. I thought I was going mental, but I guess that makes sense. Ben Davies. You know what? I think now that I think about it, I have heard him called Davis. So
yeah,
perhaps I'll she that.
My guess was always they literally just never read the name. They saw it and they were like, "Oh, that's what this is," and then they moved on. That's always been my guess.
What? But I've heard Everton's midfielder called Davies, Tom Davies, true, before. So I guess maybe they're just bad. I don't know.
Lazy, maybe they're just drunk. Who knows?
It's right. True. Nick, you got a pack.
I'm opening it quickly. Here we go.
Come on. Mommy needs a new pair of shoes.
I'm going to go quick here. Do you guys know Tony from Spain?
Oh, yes.
T-O-N-I.
With an I?
Yeah, it is. Is he good?
Like Luca Toni.
No, it's not Luca Toni. I don't know who he is. Then we have also from Spain, Ginger? I don't know how to pronounce his name. We don't know a lot of these players. This is really bad. Yeah, you guys have really said nothing. Okay, we got a USA player, so David will know. Here we go. By the way, Wijnaldum. Eric Wijnaldum. Look at that.
Oh. It's Wijnaldum. I think we've gotten this one before. Nick, it's Eric Wijnaldum. It's not Wijnaldum.
So that was, you just said the same thing twice.
No, Wijnaldum, not Wijnaldum. Come on, Nick. We got to get the names right. Otherwise, we're the British people. And then we're doing the same thing as them. You want Alfonso Davies in 30 years to have a podcaster open up his World Cup card and call him Alfonso Davis?
I'm actually his third cousin, and that's how we pronounce it. So I'm sorry.
Okay. Is that all the cards?
The other guys I've never heard of, so we're going to just skip those.
All right.
There you go.
That was productive.
Yes.
Great job, Nick. Great pack. I tried to find those Spanish players, could not find them Googling, so
there you go.
We will move on. That is it for a football podcast this week. Before we go, a reminder, we're continuing our goal to reach 30 patrons. Once we do, we'll release new interviews with newsmakers from MLS, EPL, and around the world of soccer. So make sure to head over to patreon.com/afootballpodcast to sign up today. We're also on Twitter @footballpod. And a rating or review wherever you get your podcast would be wonderful. Major thanks to Nick on the ones and twos, as well as for not losing his mind talking about VVD. Stay strong, Nick. Things will get better. And for David and myself, David, I just heard you. Yes, sir.
So I just want to say that no one on the 1994 Spanish World Cup team's name was Tony.
Yeah, I was looking at that too. I was looking at that too.
But there was a 23-year-old named Josep Guardiola, and there was a backup goalkeeper named Julian Lopetegui.
And Tixi. So there you go. Tixi was on this team as well.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff. Okay, that's it. AFP this week. We'll chat to you guys next week. Thanks for listening.